Hello, I'm Claire Castle. Thank you for joining us for a week-long series of podcasts about our native pollinators, brought to you by the Fish and Wildlife Service, an agency of the United States Department of the Interior. Today is Tuesday, June 24th, and Dave Harrelson, a biologist with the Endangered Species Program, shares information about our nation's endangered butterflies and endangered plants.
If faced with extinction, any species of fish, wildlife, or plant may be placed under the protection of the Endangered Species Act in one of two categories, endangered or threatened. And to clarify those two terms, an endangered species is one that is in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of its range, and a threatened species is one that could become endangered in the near future. When describing the reasons why various species of plants and animals are placed on the endangered and threatened species lists, we often point to a loss of habitat. This is certainly the case for some of the most beautiful endangered species, the butterflies. For most of the 24 listed butterflies, the factors leading to their endangered or threatened status include detrimental land management practices, excessive or improper use of pesticides and herbicides, reduction or displacement of native plants that they require at some stage in their life, and general habitat loss through agricultural, commercial, and residential development, without consideration of these species' biological needs. The reason why species get into trouble is expressed in the text of the Endangered Species Act this way. Congress stated that various species of fish, wildlife, and plants in the United States have been rendered extinct as a consequence of economic growth and development, untempered by adequate concern and conservation. In 1973, when President Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act, the original list of endangered and threatened species contained no insect pollinators. However, today, several species of pollinators, including butterflies, birds, moths, and bats, receive protection under the law. Listed on April 28, 1976 as threatened, the Shaw Swallowtail was the first butterfly to be protected under the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, as the law is often referred to. This butterfly was originally described by William Shaw in 1911 from specimens collected in the South Miami area in 1898. The butterfly was originally distributed in southern Florida's tropical hardwood hammocks from South Miami to lower Matecumbe Key. Hardwood hammocks are a type of forest that is on ground that is slightly elevated above the surrounding landscape. These forests are essential for the survival of the butterfly and its primary food plants, torchwood and wild lime. Though its range had never been geographically widespread, by the early 1980s, the amount of hardwood hammock habitat the butterfly requires had been significantly reduced. Other threats to the species included widespread aerial application of insecticides for mosquito control, non-native predatory fire ants, and over-collecting. The ongoing loss of habitat and food plants was pushing the Shaw Swallowtail even farther towards the brink of extinction. This resulted in the Fish and Wildlife Service reclassifying the butterfly to the more imperiled status of endangered in 1984. Today, the Shaw Swallowtail situation has improved somewhat. This has largely been due to the acquisition and restoration of hammock habitat. However, the status of Shaw Swallowtail has not yet reached that state on the long road to recovery where it can be reclassified from endangered to threatened status. Simply put, it is far easier to preserve a species and its habitat than it is to restore both back to health once damaged. The Cardinal Blue Butterfly is classified as endangered. It formerly occupied a range that extended across 12 states from Minnesota to Maine. Populations of the butterfly were also known from the province of Ontario, Canada. Today, however, the Cardinal Blue is restricted to generally isolated populations in the 7 states of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, New York, New Hampshire, and Ohio. The Cardinal Blue Butterfly is dependent for part of its life cycle on a plant, wild lupin. How? While adult Cardinal Blues feed on a variety of plants, wild lupin is the only known food plant for their larvae. Without wild lupin, the cycle of life for this butterfly would be broken. And lupins are adapted to particular environmental conditions. The plants required by the larvae of the Cardinal Blue are found in savannas, barrens, and dune habitats, which were once quite extensive. However, like many other places, the habitats of the Cardinal Blue have been subject to extensive development with the resulting decline in the butterfly. Because the Cardinal Blue larvae have a unique dependence on wild lupin, federal recovery plans for the Cardinal Blue need to include protection and management of wild lupin habitat as well. John Muir, founder of the Sierra Club, expressed nature's intricate relationships this way. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. Another example of those intricate relationships between plants and pollinators is the Fender's Blue butterfly, an endangered species. The Fender's Blue once thrived in the prairies of the Willamette Valley in Oregon. However, during the past century and a half, almost 99% of the butterfly's habitat have been converted to farmland, residential development, and other uses. Today, the remaining Fender's Blues survive only among the fragmented remains of the valley's prairies, and the largest population exists on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Basket Slough National Wildlife Refuge. Now here's the interesting part. Fender's Blue butterflies are completely dependent upon the continued existence of a threatened plant species, Kincaid's lupin. The butterflies deposit their eggs on the lupin, the eggs hatch, and the larvae winter in the plant's root system. In spring, they emerge to feed on the plant. Eventually, they metamorphose and emerge as adult butterflies, and in the 1 to 2 weeks that remain of their lives, the adults will mate and deposit the eggs of the next generation on Kincaid's lupin, continuing the life cycle. These examples help to illustrate the close interdependence between species and the importance of an integrated or ecosystems approach to conservation and species recovery. The fact that the Fender and Carner Blue butterflies are tied to specific plant species by their biology should make us think about our nation's endangered and threatened plants. Ask most people to name some endangered animals and they have no problem identifying several species. But if you ask people to name some endangered plants, well, a lot of folks draw a blank. Most people also don't realize that there are more native plants listed as endangered or threatened in the United States than there are animals. Of the plants protected under the Endangered Species Act, most are flowering species that reproduce by producing seeds, and while many of these plants are able to self-pollinate, the majority require pollinators to complete their reproductive cycle. The problem is that for many of these endangered and threatened flowering plants, we don't know who their pollinators are. In other instances, we may know who the pollinators are, but those species are no longer around or in sufficient numbers to do the job. Are they extinct? Have they somehow been driven from the places where the plants still remain? Oftentimes we really don't know, and this can lead to some really intensive recovery efforts to prevent extinction for some species of plants. The Mauna Kea silversword and Mauna Loa silversword are two endangered plant species found only on the island of Hawaii. Both require pollinators to successfully complete their life cycle. Both species may live for up to 4 decades, that's right, 40 years, before sending up a single 6-foot-tall stalk covered with hundreds of small flowers. And this is it. These plants only flower one time. After the seeds develop to maturity, the parent plant dies. To produce enough seed to create the next generation, the flowers must receive pollen from another silversword plant. The problem is, there are so few plants that rarely are two individuals flowering at the same time. Compound this problem by the fact that both plants need to be near enough to each other for pollinators to do the job that nature intended. So what is the strategy to recover these unique plants? To make up for low numbers of pollinators, individual plants flowering at different times, and plants potentially being too far away from each other for pollination to be effective, biologists become surrogate pollinators to aid the recovery of these endangered plants. Each year, biologists locate budding silversords and return when the plants are in flower to collect their pollen. They then go to other silversords as they bloom and gently brush the collected pollen onto their flowers. This mimics the cross-pollination that would naturally take place in nature. Returning in late summer, the pollinator biologists, or in this case botanists, collect seed for propagation. The young plants raised from these seeds are eventually transplanted into the silversword's natural habitat in an ongoing effort to build up the wild population to a self-sustaining level. When sufficient numbers of silversords are established, it is hoped that Hawaii's native silversword pollinators, yellow-faced bees, will more easily be able to fly from flowering silversword to silversword, and in so doing help to maintain and recover these unique Hawaiian plants. In the examples we discussed, both species, animal and plant, need coordinated recovery efforts. This applies to management decisions, restoration efforts, and physical protection of their shared habitats. As American conservationist and writer Aldo Leopold wrote, "To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering." For the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, this is Dave Harrelson.
This podcast is a product of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, a partner with the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign and the Pollinator Partnership. Tomorrow we will talk about pollinator gardening. To tune in to other National Pollinator Week podcasts and find pollinator-friendly information and products, visit www.pollinator.org.